Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsessions
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hi, it's Jackie Cation, and you are listening to the Dork Forest. The website's jackiecation.com, dorkforest.com, thedorkforest.com if you like a determiner. Let's do the credits. Patrick Brady's going to fix this audio and video. Vilmos works on JackieCation.com. And Mike Rickberg sang the song with his wife, Sarah. He composed it, and he will sing his version of the Mexican hat dance at the end of this show. Thank you so much for listening to the Dork Forest. Here's a scoop. I'm doing stand-up online. A lot of Zoom shows will eventually go back on the road. Sign up for my email list. It's easy to get off. It's harder to get on than it is to get off. And no harm, no foul, if ever bored. JackieCation.com. Sign up for the email list. You'll find out about my weekly Zoom shows and stand up on the road eventually. You may donate to the show if you would like. I would like. Sure, I would. There's PayPal, Jackie@JackieCation.com, and there is a PayPal button on both DorkForest.com and JackieCation.com, and there's Venmo if you like Venmo, Jackie-Cation, oddly enough. If you have listened to all of the shows, go to dorkforest.bandcamp.com, I think. The Dork Forest has a Bandcamp page. You can listen to a lot of ones that are free from pre-2009 when I started pre-recording. And then there's live episodes that cost me a couple of bucks, so I charge you a couple of bucks. There's also some stand-up. There's a story album that's very exciting there. And other than that, I have a lot of merch in my garage. Feel free to order if you know anybody who doesn't have any CDs or the DVD. And you can follow me everywhere at Jackie Cation. Let's get into the show. Hey, it's me, Jackie Cation. I'm in my living room, and I'm in my garage. I want to be in my living room so badly, Michael Charbonneau. Welcome to the program, Michael Charbonneau. Am I saying right? Am I doing it?
You do, yeah. Oh, you're doing better than most servers at restaurants are doing. You're great.
Stuck the landing, you guys. I went to France once. I took 5 semesters of French and then failed. I passed 3 of them. Let's go with glass half full. Welcome. You've been a longtime listener, super supporter of my stand-up career, Michael. Thank you very much. You saw all 5 tapings of
New
album of Staycation.
And I went to the practice show the night before as well.
You even saw Wednesday. I forgot about that. All right, we're married now. Because the only other person who did that, besides the people I paid, was Andy Ashcroft. So,
And I have had lovely chats with him, too.
He was great. By the end of it, you guys were like, oh, hey, how's it going? So, you were in the know. So, so we're going to do a Dork Forest, and I asked you what you were interested in, and it's been years since I've read the original Neil Gaiman Sandman, but that was my serious entry. Like, Andy didn't want to give me that as the first comic book I read, so he sort of built up to it. Okay. But I have read the Sandman Neil Gaiman.
Right.
And you as well, right?
Yes, starting with issue 1. I
just the flimsies, right? You were just buying the regular
comics. My girlfriend at the time and I, we went to this indoor consignment shop, or I think they called it an indoor flea market, but it was basically they sold consignment areas that were 10 by 10. And some would have clothes and some would have antiques and Chotskys and stuff, coins in cabinets, whatever. And there were like 2 that were comics. One was just a bunch of boxes strewn together that was like, you know, just whatever they could cram in there.
Sure.
And then the other one had like display shelves where they were in plastic and the bags. And I'm kind of looking through, and I hadn't really read any comics since I was a kid, reading like Richie Rich and Casper, which my mom discouraged because religion.
Oh.
And once in a while I'd pick up a scary comic. I love the scary comics.
Sure.
Loved scary stuff since I was a kid. So I'm going through this consignment shop, and there's this thing called The Sandman, and there's the first three issues there, and I'm like, what is this? And yeah. So I take the first one out of the bag. I didn't know about handing comics, but I think I handled it fairly carefully.
Fair enough.
And I sit down on the floor while my girlfriend's wandering around looking at whatever she's looking at, and I read through, and the next thing I know, I've read the first issue sitting there on the floor,
right,
and I'm
there.
Like, wow, this is a great story. And so I'm like, you know, it just hit all my buttons. I put it back in the bag. I grabbed the three. I got them that day. I read them. And then I'm like, where can I get more? I need
right.
to find a comic shop.
So was this in 1989? Like when it first?
It was. It was either 89 or 90. I forget how late exactly. I think it was late 89 that those came out.
Right.
So I think it might have been early 1990 because issue 8 had just come out in the comic book stores.
Okay, and they come out monthly. So
they
it would have been
monthly
8
at that
months
point.
After
I'm,
that.
I'm,
yep.
So I got number 8, and I started backfilling as well as collecting forward, and got the whole run. There's at least one in particular I can tell you where it was when I bought it and read it because of the impact of that comic that was late in the series. I don't want to give any spoilers.
Right, right.
Even though it's 30 years old, but
right, it's hard
new
to
people,
spoil something
new people,
that had
yeah.
a, that now has a TV show and
will have a TV show. It's not out yet,
oh,
so I don't want to give spoilers for
that's
that.
That's true. That's very sweet of you. Yes,
and
you're
correct. There's an Audible adaptation that is in Act 2 out of, I think it's going to be like 4 acts, so.
Oh, so the
what
first two acts are out on the Audible?
Yeah. Act 2 just came out last week.
Oh, you know what?
I am in the middle of it.
Yeah, I hear it's actually really good, too, right?
Yeah, it's really well done. There are a couple of tweaks that were made to the script
sure.
to kind of catch up with modern times, because
you gotta do it. It's...
Every writer I know is like, I am ashamed of some of the things I said when I was writing earlier.
Oh,
I have tried to correct that in my writing as I go along. So.
Oh, right, right. Oh, so there was some sort of sensitive, some jackassery that Neil Gaiman did not know was jackassery at the time.
I wouldn't even call it. Well, it might be jackassery now,
or
but
insensitive?
I mean, it would be insensitive now. But at the time, he was actually being fairly progressive.
Oh, okay.
He in one of the storylines he had a trans character. In an earlier storyline he had a drag queen, and there were just like little tweaks. He didn't need to remove the characters. He didn't need to rewrite them.
Yeah.
Just kind of update kind of the sensitivity in dealing with them.
Oh,
and
okay.
I think that's fine to do. I mean, it certainly beats putting more banthas in Star Wars.
Right. Yes, fair enough.
Because who needs that?
I looked up something on my phone, which means that I looked at my phone, Michael, and then I received text messages that for some reason, during these vital moments, you only get an hour to talk about the thing you love. I am freaking at my phone. Not okay. Okay, so we'll go over that 30 seconds to a minute. I think I read them because it ran from 89 to 96. That's what I looked up.
Right. Yep.
And I met Andy Ashcraft in 2003.
Okay.
And so that's when I read them. Would have been 2003, 2004, when he was just like, how about these? Maybe these? And a giant stack. And
right.
Every year for Christmas, I knew what to get him because I could get him. There was a $100 book of the art and the... And the story itself of Sandman. Now, traditionally, Sandman is like one of the pantheon gods from somebody's culture, right?
Correct. Correct.
Do we know offhand which culture was it?
Greco-Roman? I think one person is like, "Oh, you must be Apollo." This was a Roman emperor. Is like, "You must be Apollo," and he's like, "No, but I'm kind of maybe doing a favor for him."
Okay.
Was kind of the lowdown on that, but. The Orneomancer at one point he was called.
Okay.
And in Gaiman's universe, he's Dream of the Endless, and the Endless are considered, they're not gods, they're concepts personifications of concepts that transcend gods, because we'll always have death, whichever gods rise or fall. We will always dream, whichever gods rise or fall.
So someone to take care of these big concepts. Exactly. And it was dream, and Sandman is dream. And then there was death.
Yeah, he never calls himself Sandman. He's always Dream.
Oh, he's always Dream.
Or whatever culture he's dealing in.
Okay.
He will go by whatever name that culture has named him.
Okay.
His appearance will change based on what the culture perceives him as.
Oh, interesting. I need to reread these because they were so beautifully drawn too and painted.
They were. And the covers were amazing. There was one book where they just showed the dust covers.
Just a book of the covers?
Yes, after everything was out, all of the Dave McKean covers that he did for all 75 plus issues. I think there was one special as well as the individual issues.
Okay. So it's death.
So I will say again, I worry about spoilers, but in the beginning we learn about death, or we learn about Dream. They were trying to capture Death. They captured Dream. So we learn about those two like right away in the first one. There's Desire comes in pretty quickly.
Yep.
And talks to her sister Despair.
Yep.
And then we know that there's someone who's like behind like kind of a covered thing. And we learn of this person as the prodigal, or this Endless as the prodigal, who apparently has left. And so we don't actually know his name till like halfway through for sure.
Okay.
There are hints here and there all the way through. Pretty early on, also by the third major storyline, Delirium comes in, as well as Destiny.
And Destiny. So, that's right. So that's like five.
That's six out of the seven.
And the Prodigal's the sort of the spoiler. You don't want to spoil it.
I'd like to not spoil that, because that'll be again coming up in the Audible series. Mm-hmm. It's going to be past the part that's currently released.
Okay.
That'll be in Act Three, and then it'll definitely be part of the Netflix special. But the storyline involving them is one of my favorites. It's the Brief Lines storyline.
Okay.
Storyline. So
it's I remember, because here's now. I know that they are siblings of a sort, the Endless.
Yes, yes.
And we come in to the dreaming, to the first story of Sandman, that Sandman has been captured, and he must escape. So this is no spoiler here.
That's the first issue,
and I think in the reboot we get to meet. Are you reading the current Dreaming, not written by Neil Gaiman?
I started it when it first came out over a year ago, but I have not caught up.
Yeah, it's also stuttery, you know, like it's not regular. So it's hard to know that another one's come out unless you have a pull list. And so I just read, and for some reason, that guy that captured Dream is in.
Oh.
He's in the new one for a second.
Roderick.
The character?
Meredith Roderick?
Nice.
Something.
That sounds great.
I feel like I'm flubbing it. Anyway.
Oh, you're not flubbing it. And because I would say this. Now, the Sandman series is so interesting because Neil Gaiman, the other things that he wrote are, like he wrote that Magic series about the magical boy. The Books of Magic, which are about a young boy with brown hair. And
Timothy
glasses
Hunter.
Looks suspiciously half a decade before Harry Potter, looks almost exactly like Harry Potter.
Yep.
And so whoever did the art for the covers of the Harry Potter books clearly read the Books of Magic or saw those covers. And that boy was also a boy, you know, sort of Messiah. But, you know, nobody owns the Messiah story.
Exactly.
Not even the Christians. I'm so sorry. And it was the thing, I think, like he was always very popular, but I think Sandman put Neil Gaiman on the map, right?
Sandman was his first real real kind of breakthrough. He had done before that, he was a journalist first. Then as part of his journalism job, he got assigned to do a biography of Duran Duran.
Okay.
Which reportedly he admitted this once to Simon Le Bon, and Simon's like, oh yeah, which one? And
yeah.
Neil told him, and he's like, oh, I kind of like that one.
Oh, there you go. Oh, so you
so many like unauthorized biographies of Duran Duran.
Oh, Ghostwriter kind of. I think I read one of Billy Joel in the 80s. Yep. Anyway.
And then after I'd started reading Sandman, I became aware that he had written a book called Don't Panic, the official guide to companion to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe.
What?
And I'm like, I bought that book way back when I was interested in Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker Guide series.
Right.
I own that book. And I go and I find it in my bookcase. And yes, Neil Gaiman wrote this.
It's so interesting that British nerds all know each other. Like the
right,
Terry Pratchett,
right.
Douglas Adams, Neil Gaiman. Mm-hmm. They're just, it's, you know, it's so interesting. Was Douglas Adams, do you think, older than Neil Gaiman?
Because he
died
at least about 15
years ago, right?
It's been a while. I don't know the exact year. I did get to see Douglas Adams at a signing in Denver before he passed away. He was doing his The Last Chance to See, the one about the Galapagos. Oh, really?
I went in Minneapolis. We didn't get to see him because it was so packed. We got to hear him. We were in the back. I brought my nephew, who's clearly, he's like 40 now, and he wanted to crawl to the front, and I wouldn't let him. I regret that to this very day. Because he was a boy. He was a child. He could have totally squoze up there and got to see Douglas Adams.
I was adult, but somewhat younger than I am now. And as you know from me showing up at the comedy club, I tend to get to these things early
so I can get a good seat.
So I was seated. I was able to see him.
That is outstanding.
And listen to him. He was a joy to listen to.
Oh, that's yes. He was the Howard Zinn of science fiction. So that's my Douglas Adams accolade. And But the thing about Sandman is that, and I don't have a huge, I mean, I don't think we're spoiling it too much to say that, because it's episodic, right? There are arcs to it.
Absolutely. And so everything ends up tying in, even the short stories, you end up realizing, oh, this is kind of connected to that. It's like there are things that kind of show things in the past where the main story is going from basically 89 to 96,
right.
Kind of in real time.
Is the main story, it isn't, because now, you know what, I'll just put a spoiler alert on this one, because I don't remember enough, and I sincerely believe it will not ruin
that's fair.
The reading of
let's go spoilers. We've given people the chance to duck out if they want to.
Right.
Let's go whole hog. It's
exactly.
been out 30 years.
Exactly. It has been out 30 years. You're about to. And so I remember some amazing things about it, which was like that bar, which was a storytelling bar. The
World's End.
The World's End. That's it.
Yes.
That's been recurring in other Vertigo things, other people. So he created that, right?
He did. Yes. Yeah.
He created so many things that have been used in other Vertigo stories. Lucifer came out of this.
Absolutely. You know? The current concept of Lucifer that's being used in the TV show came out of the Sandman comics.
Right. And so the idea of death as this sort of, you know, hot 80s goth chick is awesome. Was awesome.
Yes.
There was humor. There was so much in this that I'm going to talk about your dorkdom, Michael, because I think that
I'll just be here to answer any questions you have. Go for it.
Any questions? Because I think that one of the great things about the Terry Pratchett, Neil Gaiman, Good Omens.
Yes.
Is that Terry Pratchett is a silly, he was a silly, silly man.
Absolutely.
But he was very funny. Neil Gaiman is a deathly serious man who is occasionally funny.
Yes, I will agree with that.
And so the two of them together made Good Omens. It rose both. It took the best of their things and brought it together.
Absolutely. I have seen Neil Gaiman talk just in general and answer questions to the public a few times. And he was asked about, you know, how he and Terry came to write Good Omens. And, you know, I'm me, so this is a degree removed, but I'll try to get this story as correct as I remember it. That's my disclaimer once. I'll try not to say that every time I relate a story. So he said that he had come up with this story idea, and he got like the first part of it down, and he showed it to Terry Pratchett, and then he was kind of stuck. And so he waited, and then Terry called him a little while later and said, hey, that story you have, I don't necessarily know how it ends, but I know what happens next. Do you mind if I, well, I can either run with the story that you've given me so far, or if you want, we can write it together. And because Neil Gaiman wasn't an idiot, he said, let's write it together.
Yes. Yes.
And yeah, I think it came out and showed, kind of the best of both of them.
It's true. Did he write American Gods after Good Omens?
Yes, yes. American Gods didn't come out until I was actually listening to the newly purchased audiobook when I came across the country from Denver to San Francisco in 2001.
Okay.
Late 2001, it came out. And I have an interesting Coraline American Gods story to tell you a little bit later.
Sure.
But so American Gods came out. Sandman was finished long before then.
Okay.
And it was the first thing he did since Sandman that really kind of had a little bit of the same flavor to it, dealing with gods and mythologies and stuff like that.
Do you know when Good Omens came out? Was that after American Gods?
No. That was earlier.
Right.
And honestly, let's see.
Because I wonder about the things that he wrote after that collaboration with Terry Pratchett, if it has a little more silliness to it, if it has a little more lightness to it. Because American Gods was much like Sandman.
Yeah. American Gods was 1990.
Okay. Yeah. And so when was Good Omens?
I'm sorry.
Oh, Good Omens
was 1990. American Gods was 2001.
Oh, okay. Wow. So Sandman, so Good Omens, American Gods.
Yeah.
There we go. That's why American Gods is deathly serious, but literally a little sillier.
Right.
Yeah, it is. It has a more light. I just reread American Gods as a comic book. They did a graphic adaptation of it.
Now, I know they've been doing the tie-in to the TV series. Is it that one, or is it an adaptation of the original novel?
I think it started before the TV show, and then it just continued from the TV show.
Okay.
And I have not watched. I haven't watched. There's several TV shows that I have not watched that I want to watch. American Gods being one of them. Why the Last Man, which is Brian K. Vaughan,
right?
On Hulu FX, which is I think only two episodes in. And, but that, it has sort of a zombie apocalypse kind of vibe to it, which is not my jam, even though I will read some of the darkest comic books. I cannot, for some reason, read a dark prose,
right.
And I can't watch dark TV and movies or it was scary. And like Lock and Key, I would never watch Lock and Key. I'm sure that was a beautiful rendition of comic book that I refused to read before bed.
That's one that I need to get to. I've heard wonderful things about that.
And the first, I think, three arcs of that are funny and smart. Joe Hill was so good.
Right.
So good. And it had nice, dark humor to it.
Okay.
So Sandman wasn't that funny. I mean, if the funniest character in your book is Death, that's weird, man. And I love Cain and Abel.
Sure.
Was amazing.
Yes.
And but the storylines on it and the art made it so beautiful. The Lucifer storyline was my favorite. That was when he gets the
season
keys.
Of Mists, when he quits hell.
When Lucifer quits hell and gives the key to Dream, and then all of the different gods of death from all the different pantheons are like, can I have the keys to that? Can I have that?
Some of them were like, we want to live there. We want to take it over.
Yeah.
And then Ferry is like, we want it to stay empty because we're tired of paying taxes to hell because that's part of our compact with hell. Yeah.
Right. And I think he ends up giving it to some angel because he's like, you could fix this.
Yeah, he had not decided what to do with it, and the angels are like, have you decided? And he's like, no. And they're like, hold on, we got a message from God for you.
Uh-huh.
And they're like, we are taking it over. It's going to be back to doing what it's supposed to do.
Which is a place where people punish themselves.
Yes.
And it was such an interesting version of hell, right?
Yes.
It was such an interesting version of what we do to ourselves and the creation of such a thing, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it had aspects of Dante in it, but also mm-hmm. aspects of a lot of modern conceptions of we make our own hell. So.
Nothing's more modern than Keanu Reeves when asked what happens after death. Someone asked Keanu Reeves what happens after death. I can't. Uh-huh. I don't know where that quote came from, but this is so... It might be apocryphal. Someone could check it. But supposedly, sure. Keanu Reeves, someone asked him what happens after death. And he says, the people who loved you were sad. The people who loved you are sad. Which is such... It doesn't have anything to do with you, it turns out.
Right. Okay.
It's nice. Kind of an amazing... Well done, Keanu. You know? It's... who knew?
Yep.
Yeah, so what are your and the wake? That's the one. That's the other one.
The wake. Yeah, so yeah, I mean we have the beginning where he's captured, he escapes, he gets his tools back. That's the first arc.
The first arc he has to go grab his
keys. And that has some horrifying bits in it. The bit with the 24-hour diner where John Dee is torturing those people
is just
devastating.
Yes.
And some of those characters end up connected to later characters.
Oh yeah.
And
later
storylines.
I love his through line. Yeah.
The Sandman comic to me was the first time I'd seen, I mean, it's the first I'd read novels before, and novels obviously have things where things hint at other things, foreshadowing, whatever. But this is the first thing where I'd seen a long form thing like that, where a thread was left loose and then just picked up seemingly randomly later that connected directly back toward the beginning of the story. And I'm like, this is amazing.
You're right. Because before that, all we had might have been Vonnegut or Heinlein or both of them who mm-hmm. had recurring characters.
Sure.
That were from other books that came up in new books in entirely disparate, you know, unlikely. This is the first time where you thought, no, he knew he was going to use these characters again. With Vonnegut
right.
and Heinlein, I never thought that they... I felt like that was a publisher move. People love that character. Could you bring that guy back?
Right. Well, and there was like Asimov's mood, which is like, you know, let's try to tie all of my stuff together. And so we'll make these people appear in Foundation and these people. And it's like, okay, whatever.
Right, but it feels retconny. It doesn't feel...
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It really does.
Yeah, it doesn't feel organic. And I think Neil Gaiman made it feel like he knew he wanted to create entire people.
Yeah,
that
exactly.
Could show up later. And then in his storytelling process... It felt organic when they showed up again.
Well, and there's Unity Kincaid, who fell asleep in issue one, and her granddaughter is the second main storyline, the Doll's House.
Yes.
And then that goes from there. And then there was the set of Dream Country, which is four individual one-shot stories.
Oh, yeah.
Which includes... Shakespeare performing for Dream and for Fairy, won a World Fantasy Award.
Did it?
And then the World Fantasy people went, well, we don't want comics being eligible for our award. And so they passed a rule against it. I don't know if they have opened that up or if they have made a new category since then, but...
They were
looking down their nose at comics.
Exactly. And, they gave him the award, and then the people around him were like, no, short stories are the best form of prose or storytelling.
Right.
And you're like, it's good. everything can be good.
Yeah, yeah.
It's yeah. The judgment against comic books is lifting, of course. It's, I mean, I think it's fully lifted. But it used to just be sort of this, you know, that's my dumb little brother, you know, kind of thing.
Right, right.
And now it is, it's a cash cow. You know, if you talk to comic book store owners 20 years ago, they, so many people coming in, they're like, I'm constantly getting showrunners coming in here going, what's popular among the nerd kids? And you're just like, why don't you read a comic book and get out of my store? I'm not going to do your research for you unless you are willing to pay me. And because the comic book store owners, they don't have any money. They have an obsession.
Yes. So it's like, this is my collection and I'll sell you some of it as a sideline.
Right. I'm going to try to get together this one thing that I'm trying, this holy grail over here. But in the interim, look at this saga. Yep. And so, or whatever. That's awesome.
Yep. So let's see. So that's, I can go through all of these. The Wake is the last one.
That's right.
That is, and we'll, again, spoiler alert, people.
Yep.
After Dream dies and the kindly ones, the last one is The Wake, and it, it has the actual, kind of, ceremony for
Morpheus. The death of an endless. Yes.
Yeah. For Morpheus particularly, but then someone else takes on the mantle of Dream at the same time.
And is wearing a white robe instead of a black robe.
And
that's how we know it's a different guy, but because it looks like the same guy.
And it's a different personality. And and he goes through and tries to do, you know, some good things. He's like, you know, Matthew, you can hang around if you want. You don't have to. I can find another raven.
Yep.
He tries to bring Fiddler's Green back because Fiddler's Green was part of the Dreaming. He was also from that second storyline. And we see him a little bit through the series as well in flashbacks. But he had died at one point during the Kindly Ones.
Mm-hmm.
And so Daniel tries to bring him back and he's like, I lived a good life and I'm dead. Leave me dead.
Yeah.
And of course, Fiddler's Green, you may know, patterned after G.K. Chesterton.
No, I do not know.
You did not know that.
I've never even heard of G.K. Chesterton. I bet you that's huge.
He was very, I think he was popular in his time. He had an influence on Gaiman. He wrote some kind of, I think, slightly surreal fiction. I have not read a lot of his stuff, but I went back and found one that I think Gaiman had mentioned called The Man Who Was Tuesday. And this is old enough you can find it in public domain archives.
Okay.
So you can find that. And of course, there are people still printing these things because why not make a buck off of stuff that's already
in the
free?
Public domain. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
So Gilbert Keith Chesterton was an English writer, philosopher, lay theologian. I'm a lay theologian. Come on. And literary art critic. He has been referred to as the Prince of Paradox, 1874 to 1936. Influenced by Charles Dickens, Thomas Aquinas. Wow. All right. I'm definitely going to read more about him because he sounds fascinating.
There is a quote that Gaiman put at the beginning of one of his novels. I'm not sure which one. I think it was one of the young adult ones, but it was something like fairy tales are more than true. Not because they teach us that dragons exist, but because they teach us that dragons can be defeated.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love that one.
Yeah, that's...
And it's attributed to J.K. He attributes it to G.K. Chesterton, but I'm not sure that it's an actual... I think he might have misattributed it or condensed it or made it up. But
right. You know... Because as
he points out, writers are liars, so you can't
Writers
trust
are
him.
Liars, and you know what Elliot Cation says? Don't let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure he didn't say that first. I'm sure he stole that from somebody.
I'm sure.
Because that is some of the jokes that I've written about him. He's like, remember when I said that? And I was like, I actually wrote that. You actually didn't say that at all. And he was like, I would have. I would have said that. And so.
That's you telling a great story without letting your dad's truth get in the way.
Exactly. Don't let it get in the way. And so I was once one of the first live action role playing games that I was in was a Sandman LARP.
Wow.
Andy and his buddy Lee ran three different Sandman LARPs throughout the 90s, the late 90s, right after it's, you know, like I think it was like 93, 98, 2000. And the last one they did was The Wake. And
nice.
It was 40 people in this thing. They rented a theater.
Okay.
people who wanted to could write one-act plays starring one of the Endless.
Wow.
So there were seven different sort of 10-minute, the damn thing took all day, right? And all night.
Sure.
I believe the food and wine flowed freely.
I was going to say, as a good Wake does.
Yes, so. Yes. And the different plays were, which, because we never knew at the beginning of the story, The Wake, who had died in the LARP.
Oh, okay. All right.
And so they, so in the live action role-playing game, any one of them could have died. It was all in the game mechanics.
It was like Sandman and Clue all pieced together.
Right. It was Clue with Destiny and so each of the different one-act plays were to be the death of a different Endless and how and why they died.
That sounds awesome.
It was awesome. Maria Bamford played an extra in The Death of Desire. And she played Apathy.
Oh.
And Apathy kills Desire.
that is so awesome in itself, and it is so Maria.
And they still talk about it. The 40, the people who were at that LARP were just like, Maria was amazing. And as was Jim, who wrote it and played Desire. And because Jim is an actor and Maria is an actor or can act. Right.
Right.
And just stuck it was just awesome. I was a messenger, much like my actual acting career. I had small bit parts where I just delivered things.
Right.
And so,
best friend, messenger.
Sure. Airport cop.
Right.
And so I remember the art of the covers oftentimes being, this is just going way back. I've just decided to bring us back to a new starting point, right?
Sure. Go for it.
Watercolors. Some of them were in watercolors. Right?
Well, so it's funny. The original Dave McKean covers, this was fascinating to me. And I think I learned this early on by reading the columns at the back of the comics, you know, the letter columns.
Which only Andy reads of the two of us. I never read them. And he's like, did you read that great column? Did you read that great essay? And I was like, I am so sorry to tell you I did not.
Well, and that's something that they never reproduce with the graphic novels.
So the letters,
it's like,
or the essays.
If you have them, it's because you have the original comics.
Yeah.
But I think at one point he had one of the staff or Neil had answered a question about how are these covers done, and it's Dave McKean. He would do this kind of background painting, and then he would build like 3D on top of it, and you had like. The covers had little pieces of art along the sides and tchotchkes and stuff that had to do with the content.
Yeah,
it was like a frame. And then he would take a picture of that for the cover.
Oh.
And quite involved.
$150. Like when you think about like what you get paid for cover art in comic books, I don't think it's a great deal of money.
Probably not.
No. And because I remember Andy telling me that when he looked into it, when he was in college, he wanted to be a comic book artist.
Uh-huh.
And it was eight pages for something like $150. And he was talking to his art teacher about it. The art teacher was like, wait, what? What are they doing? And he was like, that isn't livable. What is happening?
Right.
And so it's, but they were so gorgeous. And his name's Dave McKean.
Dave McKean. Yeah.
What else? McKean. Yeah.
Yeah. And Dave McKean, I don't remember if he if he wrote the script, but he did the artwork for, I want to say, Arkham Asylum.
Okay.
The original Arkham Asylum Batman.
Okay.
He's done some of his own work. He had a graphic. He was doing like a 10-part story called Cages, which the last like two issues took forever to come out. And finally they did, and they collected it in a graphic novel. Mm-hmm. So that's available. It's in its entirety. That has a little bit of kind of, it seems like normal life, but there's a little bit of magic going on in the fringes, and it impacts the characters. When Jim Henson Company was trying to make a comeback, I want to say, boy, late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay.
I might have to look at the book behind me again. But they approached Gaiman and said, we would like you to do a movie. And Gaiman's like, I want to have McKean direct, and we'll work on the concept and the art. We'll write the story, and he'll direct it. And that became a film called Mirror Mask.
Oh, wow. I remember that.
Yeah. And it definitely had a lot of the Gaiman kind of trademarks of, you know, person in the normal world, conflict, goes to another world, resolves the conflict, comes back to the normal world, things are much better for this young adult and their relationship with the other people.
And Mirror Mask was beautiful.
Coraline and all this, yeah.
Yeah, Coraline has the same, yeah.
Yeah. Mirror Mask was absolutely beautiful. Just stunning, weird, beautiful art on the screen. If people have not seen Mirror Mask, they should go out and find it. It's not going to be, it's kind of like if Labyrinth was serious.
Oh, right. Oh my God. That's a perfect
analogy. And didn't
have
David Bowie's crotch as a main star in the film.
Right.
Maybe a little scarier than Labyrinth. So you might not want to sit your four-year-old down to watch it. But,
right, yes.
But I think it's a good preteen teen movie.
Yeah, 11 and up, I would say.
Yeah.
So Mirror Mask, 2005 fantasy film, designed and directed by Dave McKean, written by Neil Gaiman. Nobody's in it. Nobody famous. So,
no. Lenny Henry has a little bit of a following. He had kind of a small part in it, but
part. He doesn't come up in the first five.
Right,
people.
Right. Lenny Henry was he was in a comedy British series called Chef way before Jon Favreau did his film Chef.
Yes.
He has also done. He did the reading for the Anansi Boys. Audible. So which is kind of a funny sequel to American Gods.
Okay.
If you haven't read Anansi Boys, you absolutely should.
Anansi Boys is pretty great too, actually.
Yeah.
It turns
out
I might have read a lot of Neil Gaiman.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I read Coraline. I read Mirror. Yeah.
So let me tell my Coraline story.
Please.
In 2000. Mm-hmm. I was living in Denver. The World Horror Convention came to Denver. It was that city. They like World Con. They travel around different cities, and so the World Horror Convention was there. Went with my girlfriend, and I don't remember. We might have even stayed in the hotel. We were local, but I don't remember anyway. But we were. Neil Gaiman was there along with many, many other people. Peter Straub was there.
Wow.
Not like Stephen King, but he wasn't nominated for anything.
Right.
They were giving out the World Horror Awards, which I have a story about Gaiman and the World Horror, Horror Awards too.
Okay.
So, anyway, one night, Neil's like, hey, you know, I'm going to read kind of a story. We're going to start. It's a late night story. We'll start about 10:30, I think it was 10, maybe. Maybe even as late as 11. But so he starts. He says, I'm going to read you. I can either read you from something that that I've already done, or something that is about to come out, or something that will come out later.
Okay.
And we're like, let's do the thing that's going to come out later. So we get a little bit of an advance preview.
Yeah.
We voted on that. Maybe 40 of us in the room.
Okay.
At most. Like an upstairs convention room off the main path. So between 20 and 40 of us, and we're sitting there, and Neil Gaiman starts reading Coraline. And he says, he gets about halfway through the book, and it's been like maybe an hour and a half. And he says, guys, I need to, my throat is dry.
Yeah.
I either need to stop for the night, or if you want, we can take a break for about 15 minutes. We can hit bathrooms. We can get something to drink, and I can keep reading. And we're all, are you insane? Yes. We will take our break and we will come back because we want to finish
this
story.
It's a horror convention and all cons are all night.
So it's like 12:30 at this point.
Right.
So we're looking at staying up till like 1:30, listening to Neil Gaiman tell us a bedtime story.
Yeah.
So he reads the rest of Coraline, and he says, and we're like, when's it going to be out? We want to get this book. And he's like, well, this one is done.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still working on American Gods, which isn't quite finished.
Mm-hmm.
But my publisher wants to put out American Gods first.
Right.
So that adults are more familiar with me, so that when a kid says, hey, I want this Neil Gaiman book, the adults will go, oh, I know that name, and they will buy the book for their kids.
Okay.
So we got to hear Coraline, which was done first, like, I don't know, at least 2 years before it was
released. It had to be 88, because didn't you just say American Gods came out in 90? No, 2001.
Yeah. So yeah. 2001 was
99.
American Gods.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this was the 2000 was the horror festival where we listened to it.
Nice.
World Horror Convention. So yeah. So it was a lot of fun. The other highlight of that convention for me.
Sure.
Two highlights. One was that my girlfriend at the time had this bunny that she liked taking to cons and getting pictures of the bunny with
a
local actors.
Rabbit?
No. It was a stuffed toy. It was a
bunny.
Stuffed animal.
There you go.
It was cute.
Sure.
And at one point,
she could bring much worse things than a stuffed bunny. Anyway.
Absolutely, so. She could. So we catch Neil Gaiman. He's down on the 16th Street Mall where the hotel is, having a cigarette. And my girlfriend's like, would you mind if we had you take a picture with this? And he's like, no, absolutely. And he like holds it up, pointing to it. If I can find the picture, I'll send it to you.
Yes, please.
It's delightful.
That's awesome.
I should tag Neil in it too.
We can all tag Neil.
but it's cute. It's wonderful. So that, and then my girlfriend, we're waiting to get a book signed by Harlan Ellison, who was also there.
Sure.
He was having none of that crap. He is a serious author. He would never have his picture taken with
a stuffed
bunny.
Look what I brought for Harlan Ellison.
Oh,
anyway,
that's very appropriate. Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Exactly.
It's that old bird thing.
Harlan Ellison is known as a
hard ass.
As a hard ass and a sexist, and I mean,
didn't he slap someone's ass? Connie Willis?
No, he grabbed Connie Ellis's boob on stage, as I recall.
Okay.
I would have to look up the incident again, but I think it was a boob
grab.
Connie
Willis.
I don't think it was.
Yeah. She wrote Doomsday Book, right?
She wrote Doomsday Book. She's written, she is so wonderful. She was the first woman. She was To Say Nothing of the Dog.
To Say Nothing of the Dog, yeah. I loved both of those were my two favorite of hers.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and they're basically the same universe.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, no, they are.
Oh, are they? Okay.
Yeah, they're set in the current time in the book is set in Oxford, where they have a time traveling division.
Yes, they do.
And then they go to the Black Plague accidentally, and then they go to this Victorian age.
Accidentally.
The Victorian Age was on purpose, but the guy like bonks his head and loses his memory.
Right.
And comedy ensues. Unlike the Doomsday Book, where everything is miserable.
Everything is miserable. She's like, we're not going to go when it's the Black Plague. Clearly, I don't want to go during, and I've been inoculated. I've been vaccinated anyway, but we're going to go just before it. I just want to do a little social studies about before the Black Plague. And then, of course, a fuse blows and she ends up in the middle of the Black Plague. So there you go.
So the other Neil Gaiman story, we'll get back to Gaiman. There's the banquet where they're going to give out the World Horror Awards. I believe it's like a little Lovecraft figurine.
Okay.
And there's different categories, and I am sitting at a table. I'm like, I could just go and sit at Neil's table, but I don't have the guts for that. So I'm like, me and my girlfriend, it's like, I know some other local authors around there.
Sure.
And so, okay. So I sit at a table with Trish Kasich, Peter Kachik. She's not as well known, but she's done some wonderful work. She was living in Denver at the time, has now moved back east. But so I'm like, I know her. We'll sit with her. And, you know, Peter Straub joins us at our table. And it's like, okay, well, we have people here. And it's like, you know, my mind's being blown by all the kind of leading horror writers around the room.
Right.
We're sitting there. Neil Gaiman has been nominated for Sandman, The Dream Hunters, which is more prose than comic, but it has some beautiful illustrations by a Japanese illustrator that he met when Gaiman was doing the interpretation for the movie Princess Mononoke. Studio Ghibli movie.
Yeah.
That's
Michael Charbonneau's other dorkdom, by the way.
Yes.
But knowing your heart, as you can imagine, a bit of a diamond. Many facets of a dork horse diamond. Yes, go ahead.
Indeed. So he'd met this artist and wanted to do a Japanese dream story. And so, you know, consulted with this guy a bit, and this guy did the art, and it came out beautiful, and it was nominated for this fantasy horror award, and he wins, and so he gets up from his table, he walks up to the platform they have there in the room, and he gets behind the thing, and he's holding the award, and he says, you know, thank you very much. It's always great, and you sit down there at the table and you say to yourself, it's an honor to be nominated. It's an honor just to be nominated. And you say it so long to yourself that it blurs together. It's just an honor to be nominated as one word. And it is an honor to be nominated, but it's also really fucking great to win the award. And he walks off the stage to applause, as you can imagine.
Awesome.
But yeah, so it was great to see him to be there when he won something like that.
Right. Just to be in the room sort of when those things happen. You get to hear like really great speeches, really kind of weird. Sometimes there's like weird one-off stories that somebody tells and you're like, more please, more please. You're just like, what else happened in your life that was interesting?
Yes.
I love it. An interesting story. It's why we read, right? It's why we do any of this stuff. It's for the interesting story. So if you got a real one, let's hear it.
Yep.
That's awesome.
Let's see. Yeah.
So those are your Neil Gaiman stories?
Those are the two main. I mean, I've been to a number of signings. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you about the first signing I went to. Season of Mists had just come out as a hardback. So back up a little bit in Neil's timeline. They finished what is now known as Preludes and Nocturnes, which is the first one where he escapes and gets his tools back.
Right.
They finished that comic run and then they went through The Doll's House.
Yeah.
And then The Doll's House they released as a graphic novel without having released the first one. So Neil wrote this kind of one page, the story so far, that basically covered the events that are in. And it started with issue 8, which is kind of like, it's like between the two. It's like a Venn diagram where it's like it finishes the first one, but it also sets up the second one.
Yes.
But they wanted to have it in the only graphic novel they were sure they were publishing at the time.
Okay.
So then that comes out. I don't remember. They may have released it before they released the third and fourth ones. So the third one was Dream Country, which was the 4-1 things. And then there was Season of Mists, which was a big thing. And they're like, okay, for this one, we're going to go hardcover. We're going to release a hardcover for this one. So I'm like,
You went to the signing or something.
Yes, I did. So I was living in Denver. Boulder is like 30 miles up from Denver.
Yeah, it's
like,
40
minutes. I wasn't driving at the time.
Oh, shit.
I had to figure out the bus schedule for this city-to-city bus. It was still part of the local system because there were enough people traveling back and forth.
This is a nerd dream come true.
How do I get there? I think it was a work day, so I had to take a Tuesday off of my job and hop on a bus at some weird time and get there around noon. So I go and
it's got to be a 2-hour bus ride there and back. There and then 2 hours back.
Just
because of stops and routing and
Well, I mean, the main part was an expressway, so once it got on the highway, you were good for a while. But
good grief.
It took me a while to get there. I got the book. I got it signed. It's this one. I'm sorry. I know this isn't a show and tell, but this is the cover.
The video's available on YouTube. Oh, that's very beautiful. Nice.
And here's Time Warp Comics had this plate that they put in for him to sign on the hardcover ones, and it's numbered 95 out of 150.
Sure.
But the thing is, it's other places just had him sign the book. I don't know what Time Warp Comics was trying to prove by having this book plate
special.
That was numbered. It was very weird.
Right.
That was the first time I met Neil Gaiman, and I've been to a number of signings, both in the Denver area. It's nice being in a city where people stop.
Yes.
Because he would stop in Denver regularly, either at a comic shop.
You're in the San Francisco, the Bay Area now, right?
Now I'm in the San Francisco area. I've seen him a number of times around here. His son, not the younger one with Emil, with Amanda Palmer, but his grown-up son, who he had with his first wife, is living up in the kind of North Bay, Napa County area.
Okay.
And so sometimes he'll do a stop at Santa Rosa when he's going to visit his son.
Okay.
He'll be like, hey, I'm going to be in the area at this time. Do you guys want to? And they're like, yes, please.
Yes.
We'll send it out.
I wish you had more kids and they were spread out more.
Right. Exactly. And one of those, my current girlfriend and I, we paid for the meet and greet.
Mm-hmm,
and I had done some meet and greets with Weird Al Yankovic, and it was very much like a signing line where it was like, bring something up, you know, we'll give you a set list or a picture, or you can bring something, but he'll sign a couple things, you can take a picture with him, and then on to the next person.
Right.
And so it was much more like a signing line. The Neil Gaiman meet and greet at Santa Rosa, it's like before the show, they brought us in. They put us in a small room. We showed up like an hour and a half early.
Okay.
And then when he gets there, he has an assistant with him to kind of keep things focused so he doesn't miss his stage time. But and we have reserved seats. Everybody has reserved seats anyway in the theater, so we don't have to worry about scrambling in for a seat. But, you know, group of, again, maybe 20 to 40 people sitting around tables. They have snacks available.
Okay.
We have some snacks. Gaiman comes in and he just walks the room and talks to people for a few minutes at a time. And wonderful, it felt like what I thought a meet and greet should be instead of a signing.
Note to self, if ever meet and greets are in my future, don't necessarily just do, well, because, you know, like merch lines, you know, like when it's just that's the Weird Al thing, has a little bit of that vibe to it, except for that you've already purchased the thing. You don't have to buy anymore. But he'll,
right.
And it's nice to get a picture and to sign stuff, but I'm sure Neil Gaiman was willing to do that too.
Well, and I was wearing a shirt that was, I had bought that was part of a benefit for the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund.
Sure. Which one?
And which shirt?
We get them every year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It was the one that had, I think I have two of them.
Right.
But the one that I wore was the one of Neil as Aziraphale with the flaming sword over his shoulder.
Awesome.
Do you have that one?
I don't have that one.
Okay.
And so we must have skipped some years or something. But that's,
maybe.
And some of them were more comfortable than others.
Yeah.
Like for some reason, they're using a different, I was like, if they found a brand that they liked, and then I would know what that brand was, I could, it would help.
I feel like I have literally hundreds of t-shirts. I have about...
You get a free new Dork Forest t-shirt for doing this program, by the way.
Right.
design is coming out. I should get it next week. Ooh. It's not a new design. It's a new color. It's Black Ranger t-shirt is phased out. And the green and brown Dork Forest t-shirts are phased out. So it's going to be the Dork Forest logo on a black t-shirt.
Perfect.
So there you go.
I wear a lot of black.
You wear a lot of black. So which one are you wearing today?
Oh, so this is a fan one. Someone did a tarot card of death.
Yes.
This was available like through T-Fury or one of those kinds of sites.
Sure.
But it was just a lovely image that someone drew up. So I had to get this. But I have a lot of the official ones from Graffiti Designs also. I think the first one I got was a picture of Dream from the comic of Ramadan.
Oh.
Where he's holding this globe filled with demons and he's got fireworks going on behind him. It's just a beautiful shirt.
Yeah. Sometimes
I've still got all these. Some of them do not fit anymore. So they're kind of in a lower drawer filed away for
a better day or a different day.
For a different day or to, you know, just to history. Have. Something like that.
Jimmy
T-shirt
Pardo.
Scrapbook, right?
Jimmy Pardo was on this program and he talked about how his Chicago t-shirts that he had bought in high school and college, he had grown out of them. Mm-hmm. And so he gave them all away and then he lost a bunch of weight and now he's been trying to repurchase all of them on eBay, but they're not his. So they don't fit right.
Oh,
they've been
worn by someone else.
So you are correct to save them. Michael Charbonneau, it has been an hour. And I just
want people
to know that this has been a delight. And it's been a spoiler episode. But it really, I don't think you can spoil this stuff. It's so fascinating and so dense. And there's so many different angles to it that we haven't really given anything away, I don't think.
I've reread this thing at least 5 times.
Yeah.
Usually in different formats. I've gotten.
Yes,
they are right here. Let me show you one of these. Let me show your audience one of these, because this is the slip cover.
That's right. That's
and then the book in here.
Yeah, Andy has all of them.
Absolute Sandman. This leather tome that would have been appropriate in. Roderick Burgess's library. That's his name. I remembered now. With the art just blown up to an incredible size.
Yeah, it's really... Have
pictures.
You read it in that version? Because it's really hard.
And this one I also got signed hugely by Neil Gaiman.
That is awesome. Is that the first one?
This is volume one.
So he didn't sign all 8 volumes, right? Did he?
Is there 8? I have 6.
6. Oh, all 6.
Including the newer one, Overture. There were 5 that were the main series. I think at least 4 out of 5 of these are signed.
Oh, that's nice. I've wanted to reread them, and that would be the way to do it because they're on the bookshelf.
Oh, it's
but
lovely.
But they're very
yes.
heavy, and they're very.
They are.
It's hard to, like a comic book, you could just lie there and read them.
Right, right. You lie down on bed face down. You have the comic book below you.
Yes,
it's not a
this
lap
thing,
comic.
That is a lap comic, and you're just like you could hear the crackle
I think
of the.
My laptop may weigh less than this volume actually.
Exactly.
So yeah.
Michael, thank you so much for doing the show. It's always a delight to see you, and I see you a lot, and I appreciate that.
It's always wonderful to talk to you about anything.
Right, and this was fascinating. Everybody should definitely find Neil Gaiman's stuff. Find Sandman, watch the shows, and enjoy. And watch Good Omens, too, because they did a real nice job with that as well.
Yeah, I recently rewatched Good Omens.
Prime.
Sorry, Amazon had it out. Yeah, Amazon Prime they had recorded it in 4K.
Yeah.
But it came out just before I got a 4K TV.
Oh,
so
okay.
I just recently rewatched it on my 4K TV to get all the bright and shinies.
Guess what? We could still talk forever, but we're not going to. So Rangers,
okay.
Remember the rules out there. Take care of each other.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat, my hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh, my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?